Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. It's been 1 week since two bombs exploded near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, killing three people and injuring almost 200 others. And at exactly 2:50 today, the time the first bomb went off last Monday, most of Massachusetts paused in a moment of silence. About an hour earlier today, 19-year-old Jahar Sargayev was charged in a federal complaint in his hospital room for his alleged role in the bombings.
Sargayev was apprehended Friday night in Watertown and remains in serious condition with a wound to his neck. White House spokesman Jay Carney says Sargayev will be tried in federal court and not treated as an enemy combatant.
We will prosecute this terrorist through our civilian system of justice. Under U.S. law, United States citizens cannot be tried in military commissions.
Sargayev is charged with using and conspiring to use a weapon of mass destruction. WBUR's David Boeri has been following these latest developments, and he joins us now. David, can you explain these charges exactly?
Yeah, very simply, the two counts. The first, using a weapon of mass destruction, conspiring to use one that results in death. That's the takeaway from this, because this is a death penalty case. He's facing either death or life imprisonment.
Is that why the government decided to go this legal route, David, or why exactly?
Yeah, two reasons. Because the death penalty would not be available in the state courts in Massachusetts. That's a very big reason. And the second is that he is a U.S. citizen. And although there are calls and have been calls, and I expect there still will be calls to try him in front of a military tribunal, the fact is he's an American citizen. The crime was committed on American soil. And by the law, he's no different than Timothy McVeigh, an American citizen who blew up the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City.
Hmm. Now, David, in this affidavit from the FBI that was released today with the criminal complaint against Sargayev, there are some very chilling descriptions of the evidence so far against him. Some of it talking about that video footage that we've heard about for the past couple of days that led authorities to Sargayev. Can you describe a little bit of that for me, David?
Let's go to the affidavit of the special agent that was filed as part of this criminal complaint. And here he's talking about at 2:45 bomber number two. That bomber number two is Jokar. It says bomber number two can be seen detaching himself from the crowd and walking east on Boylston Street toward the marathon finish line. He appears to have the thumb of his right hand hooked under the strap of his knapsack and a cell phone in his left hand. Approximately 15 seconds later, he then can be seen apparently slipping his knapsack onto the ground. And a photograph taken from the opposite side shows the knapsack, on the ground at his feet. Approximately 30 seconds before the first explosion, he lifts his phone to his ear as if he is speaking on his cell phone and keeps it there for approximately 18 seconds. As soon as he finishes the call, the large group of people around him can be seen reacting to the explosion. And here, virtually every head turns to the east or the finish line and stares in that direction in apparent bewilderment and alarm. Bomber 2, virtually alone among the individuals in front of the restaurant, appears calm. He glances to the east and then calmly but rapidly begins moving to the west, away from the direction of the finish line. He walks away without his knapsack, having left it on the ground where he had been standing. And then 10 seconds after that, that one goes off. That's from the visual surveillance. Another point. Here you have the two brothers. We're talking about the carjacking that happens on Thursday night. And although the two brothers, this particular individual, the two brothers, isn't identified, here is the evidence according to the special agent. When the victim rolled down the window, the man reached in, opened the door, and entered the victim's vehicle. The man pointed a firearm at the victim and stated, "Did you hear about the Boston explosion? I did that." Now, there you have an admission
And that was apparently the person who was carjacked on the evening that led to the whole shootout with police, the older brother, the older Tsarnaev, being shot to death and killed, and then the lockdown of Boston, and then the capture of Jahar Tsarnaev and his hospitalization today.
Right. Okay. And so we don't know which brother that is, but now you have an admission. And finally, in another indication of the devastating amount of evidence that's here, there's a search of Jokar's dormitory room, and the report. FBI sees from his room, among other things, a large pyrotechnic, a black jacket, and a white hat of the same general appearance as those worn by Bomber 2 at the Boston Marathon. You know, you look at this evidence, it seems to be overwhelming, and now Marion Conrad is going to be the public defender. She's been given the case, and I think it's fair to say that her job in this is ultimately comes down to saving her client from the needle.
All right. WBUR's David Boeri, I'm sure, will continue to talk about this legal case for many, many months to come. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
As we continue to learn more about the bombings, one tantalizing revelation is that back in 2011, Russia asked the FBI for information about Jahar Tsarnaev's older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who was killed last week in the shootout with police in Watertown. That prompted the FBI to send out agents to talk with him.
They reported back that there was nothing to be concerned about, which has prompted some, such as Senator Lindsey Graham, to accuse the Bureau of, quote, dropping the ball. Whatever the case, Tamerlan traveled to Russia in January of last year and stayed there for almost 7 months. We don't know yet, though, what he did there.
Well, joining us now to talk about the FBI investigation is Christopher Voss, who spent 24 years in the FBI, including time as a hostage negotiator. He's now the CEO of the Black Swan Group and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. And welcome to Radio Boston, Christopher Voss. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony. It's my pleasure to be here.
And let's start with that fact about the FBI meeting with Tamerlan Tsarnaev back in 2011. At the very least, this is already leading to some tough questions about what happened there. Does it suggest to you that the FBI might have dropped the ball?
No, it doesn't. I mean, there's a lot of things we don't know about that interaction. I mean, first of all, I think we're going to see that the FBI followed their procedures properly on the case. This was a lead from Russia, after all, and certainly we have reason to be dubious of them as they are of us. But you also don't know the development of the individual's mindset after the interview. And at that point in time, if they didn't uncover any wrongdoing or any reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing, they had no choice but to close the case.
But what would have happened to that information from that 2011 meeting between the FBI and Tsarnaev? I mean, for example, why wouldn't it have helped investigators identify Tsarnaev from those first pictures that emerged from the marathon?
Well, as soon as they found out that they could attach a name to the pictures, then that's when they begin to make the connections.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the information from the interview would have been retained in a case file and in a manner that makes it searchable and retrievable so that if something else does come up on him, as obviously it did, the information can be called back up and added into the investigation. There isn't any sort of magical photographic software that could have matched up any photos that would have been contained in a file quickly enough with the bombing investigation to be added in that way.
What's the FBI's main focus going to be now? Now that there's a suspect in custody, as we just heard, now that there's a suspect who has been charged, what's the focus of the investigation from this point forward?
Well, they've got two things that they really need to run on quickly. And the first is making sure that there isn't additional imminent threat from co-conspirators, people that might have been involved that would still be targeting other locations. They got on that rather quickly, and they had a lot of information to that effect in terms of being able to seize their records, their phone books, their address books, their telephone records, their computer activity. They can get a pretty good idea of something like that right away. The way it's been reported, the two brothers were active in social media, so a lot of leads there. Following that, they got to make the case. Just because it appears that there's a lot of information, a lot of evidence to be had, doesn't mean that they need to be sloppy. They need to be very deliberate and bring everything forward so that in the American court system that they can prove them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and they can do it by the rules.
Mm-hmm. Now, we understand that the suspect, Jahar Tsarnaev, can't talk right now. It's our understanding, I mean, it has been reported that the investigators have been communicating with him through written notes. What's your thinking about what they are trying to understand through those written notes back and forth?
Well, it's just another means of communication. It's an opportunity for them to develop the type of relationship with him that the information will begin to flow out of him to the investigators.
Mm-hmm.
A good interviewer, interrogator, is going to want to put himself in a position where the person he's interviewing wants to give the information. And however he's relaying the information, they'll study each and every behavioral cue that he gives them while he's communicating with them so that they can have a pretty good idea of whether or not he's being deceptive or whether or not he's telling the truth. And they'll get the flow of information started from him, and the idea, once that flow gets started, it should be come very quickly, and there should be a lot of it. It sounds to me like they're probably doing a very good job getting that flow of information started out of them.
I imagine that in any major case like this, an organization like the FBI is going to, I mean, it's probably too early for this, but that they'll do reviews of what worked and what didn't work. I'm just wondering, as a professional in this field, as you look at this case, what lessons would FBI agents be learning from this case?
Well, there's a lot of different aspects to this case that there are special agents in the FBI that really develop an expertise in that they're going to want to learn as much as possible. I mean, the FBI bomb techs are going to want to learn everything about the way these guys put together the bombs, where they got the information. The profiler is going to want to learn more about these guys from the type of person who would put together this sort of a bomb, and the guys that work terrorist profiles are going to look very hard at the type of people that are susceptible to being recruited into a life of a killing journey where they terrorize other people. Hostage negotiators are going to take a very close look at this, at the behavioral cues and the communication that our two bombers put off, because the type of instance where a bomber who's on a killing journey, such as these two people were, where they become isolated and barricaded someplace away from the destination of the killing journey, and it's quite likely they're going to give up as a result because they're cornered in a location that's not where they wanted the journey to end up.
Sure.
And so they look at that behavior and the possibilities there and realize that the chances are much greater of catching a bomb maker someplace where he doesn't want his bomb to go off. So how do you communicate with them to get them to surrender?
Mm.
So there's an awful lot to be learned here.
A lot to be learned. Mr. Voss, one more question, and it sort of brings us full circle. I'm interested in this theme of cooperation with the Russians. As we mentioned, the Russians at a certain point had asked the FBI for information about Tamerlan Tsarnaev. What about international cooperation in this case? Will the Russians, for example, be eager to share information with us and vice versa? Is that potentially fruitful?
Well, both sides are going to want to share information, and at the same time, these are two sides that have been very wary of one another for quite some time now. Mm. So there are a lot of efforts to establish good liaison between the FBI and the Russian FSB, I believe it is, so that information is flowed. But there are lots of obstacles there, too, not the least of which that, you know, we've been wary adversaries for a long time.
Right.
But there is going to be a very definite desire to share information, and it'll be shared. It'll just be shared slowly and carefully.
Slowly and carefully. Christopher Voss spent 24 years in the FBI, including time as a hostage negotiator. He's now the CEO of the Black Swan Group and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. Christopher Voss, thank you very, very much. We appreciate it.
Anthony, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
And stay with us. Up next, marathon bombing victim Crystal Campbell is memorialized in her hometown of Medford. I'm Deborah Becker.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.